morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 27th of March. There is just so much going on that we thought we wanted to talk to Craig Gilbert about all that's going on. Of course, what's happening before the Supreme Court, the historic hearings on same-sex marriage. They continue today with hearings on the Defense of Marriage Act. We've talked a lot about, although never spent a whole lot of time on this issue, and that's how the Republican Party is going to get more votes in upcoming elections. They released a report. It was a 100-page report, Growth and Opportunity Project, that was prepared by the Republican National Committee. And it was rejected by Tea Party members of the Republican Party. We'll look at the split between establishment Republicans and grassroots conservatives and what the party plans to do to attract voters who in increasing numbers have been voting Democratic. Scott Walker is giving indications that he is going to run for president. He is writing a book, and we'll talk about that with Craig Gilbert. The person who's working on that with him is a former speechwriter for George W. Bush. So Craig is a perfect person to talk about all that's happening. Our phone number, he is Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and has joined us on many occasions. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. You can use all of those ways of getting a hold of us. Hello, Craig. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning.
There is a lot going on, isn't there?
Yeah. As always.
As always. This week seems to be even more so. Let's start with the Republicans and this report they did on Growth and Opportunity Project. How are the Republicans planning to get more voters?
Well, the report covers a lot of ground. I mean, part of it is substantive. Part of it is mechanical and process and, you know, running more effective campaigns. There's a lot in there about data and technology and trying to close the gap with Democrats that really emerged in the last couple of campaigns where Democrats just proved to be much better. Their polling was better. Their data was better. They were much more sophisticated in the way they identified their supporters and the way they mobilized their supporters. This is all, you know, I think, recognized in the report by Republicans as kind of a wake-up call. That's one piece of it. But then there's also a pretty stark recognition of the demographic issues and challenges facing the Republican Party, that just, you know, how poorly Republicans are doing with non-white voters, with younger voters, with single women, with groups that in some cases are increasingly large parts of the electorate. And so there's a sense of Republicans kind of fighting a demographic tide. And so there's a recognition of that in the report and kind of a call to arms for Republicans to try harder, to kind of open up a dialogue, to play for these voters, to not assume they're going to lose every one of them. There was one big substantive piece in the report on that front, which was calling on the party to support comprehensive immigration reform, which is a pretty vague term, and it doesn't really tell you how far the party should go. The RNC really isn't in a position to dictate policy to Republican elected officials, but there is a sense in the party that it needs to shift on immigration reform in order to do better with Latino voters. So there's a lot in the report, for an internal kind of post-mortem autopsy kind of document by a political party. Some people may not think it goes far enough, but as these things go, it's pretty stark in its language in terms of recognizing that the party has a problem.
Mm-hmm. So how do you address the demographic tide? Do you change positions on certain kinds of issues? How do you believe that you can receive a whole lot more votes from the African-American community, the Latino community, the female community? It would seem as though you would have to change your positions on quite a few things.
Well, that's the big question. It depends on what you believe the nature of the problem is. Mm-hmm. Certainly, when it comes to the Latino vote, that's where you sort of get the recognition in the report that there has to be some policy changes, particularly on immigration. There is a bigger question here, which, you know, is hard to answer, but how much, for example, of the Republican Party's problems with Latino voters is a matter of the party's stance on immigration reform and the party's rhetoric, and the rhetoric from some people in the party that has come across to some people as anti-immigrant. Let's say you solve those two things, or at least do something about those two things, then the question is, how far does that get you? I mean, there's some people that think that there's a bigger problem the Republican Party has with, for example, Latino voters, which is the argument there is that it's not just immigration and it's not just tone. It's also the party's sort of limited government conservatism is not a great fit with these voters either. So that's a bigger argument and a bigger question that we'll start to see an answer to if the party does make some changes. But it certainly it's fair to ask how far the party has to go in terms of policy to improve its broaden its appeal to some of these groups where it's been doing poorly. I mean, what we're talking about, I mean, there's this sort of interesting dichotomy in the recent history of the Republican Party, where the party did so well in the 2010 midterm elections, but did so poorly in the 2008 and 2012 presidential race. And it kind of gets back to this question of, two electorates. I mean, there's a midterm electorate, which is smaller right. and wider and older, that the party has done very well with. But then there's a presidential electorate, which is bigger and more diverse, and that's the electorate that the party is struggling with. And that's where the real problem lies.
Reince Priebus also talked about the fact that the primary process was so long, so many debates, so many candidates, and they kind of ate each other up. Is that something they need to look at, or is that just a superficial change that may be good to make?
Well, it may be good to make. I don't think those things are too decisive, because I think, you can fiddle with the mechanics and the process, but the fact is that the sort of political dynamics shift every 4 years, and it's really the kind of the nature of the field, the nature of the candidates, and how that has more impact on, whether it's a long race or a short race or a messy race or a clean race than the rules do. So you can mess around with the rules, but it's really more about, how big is the field, how competitive is the field, is there somebody that emerge that can unify the party, that can emerge, how fractured is the party and how fractured is the field. That has a lot more impact on how protracted and damaging the primary process is than anything else. But there, some of these things might make sense. I mean, they want to move up the convention, which probably does make sense. Whatever happened in 2012, it's going to be a very different situation in 2016, if for no other reason than they're not going to be facing an incumbent president in 2016. I mean, a big part of their problem, the Republican Party's problems, certainly mechanical problems in 2012, were just a byproduct of the fact that you had an incumbent president who had 3 years to plan his reelection, and a Republican Party that didn't have a nominee until well into the election year, and that's going to put you at a disadvantage in terms of putting together a general election campaign. The same thing happened to Democrats in 2004 when they were going up against the incumbent president, George W. Bush, and he had all this time to sort of fine-tune and hone his campaign machine. And it was a very sophisticated campaign, more sophisticated than the Democratic campaign.
What about the quality of the candidates? The Washington Examiner had an editorial saying that the problem really was the quality of the candidates.
Well, yeah. I mean, the candidate, and I don't think Reince Priebus would disagree with that. I mean, the candidates are everything in some sense. I mean, you have... if you have a great candidate, I mean, that solves a lot of problems. Mm-hmm. And so it's hard to separate these things out. I mean, clearly Mitt Romney was a flawed candidate. If they can find, capture that magic in their candidate. I mean, the greatest candidates are candidates who sort of have the ability to both energize their base and excite their base and yet still appeal to voters in the middle and voters, sort of undecided voters. And it's hard to do. And, to some degree, Bill Clinton pulled that off. To some degree, Barack Obama pulled that off. To some degree, George W. Bush pulled that off. It's something that successful candidates do, but it's not easy to do.
What about the Tea Party? One of the leaders, co-founder of the Tea Party, Jenny Beth Martin, said, "We don't need an autopsy report from the RNC to know they failed to promote our principles and lost because of it."
Yeah, and, you know, there is some grumbling on the right about the report, and I don't know if that particular Tea Party person speaks for the whole Tea Party or everybody on the right. I kind of doubt it, but I think there was a lot of diverse reaction among conservatives. Some people thought that social conservatives were getting short shrift, and this was kind of a this report represented kind of the mindset of establishment Republicans, sort of economic conservatives who wanted to kind of downplay social issues. And there may be something to that. I mean, there are, in any party that's gone through this kind of defeat, there's going to be divisions and fault lines. And so there is some suspicion among some conservatives about the report. But I don't think it's, I think it's hard to generalize too much about that.
Well, I'm wondering how it's interesting to watch how the Democrats, one by one, and in fairly great numbers the last couple of weeks, have come to the defense of same-sex marriage. I wonder how the Republicans deal with this. It wasn't that long ago, as you well know, Craig, that there were big movements for a constitutional amendment to define marriage, you know, and to really push for a ban on same-sex marriage all over the country. Things are going in the opposite direction and in a hurry. How do the Republicans deal with that issue?
Yeah, in fact, I'm writing about this right now.
Oh, are you?
If you go back to our marriage referendum in 2006, I mean, everybody remembers that we passed a same-sex marriage ban. In fact, it would also address civil unions, not by name, but it went beyond just banning same-sex marriage. And what people may not remember about that referendum was how lopsided it was. I mean, it was 59% to 41%, and it passed by lopsided margins in a Democratic year. I mean, this was the same year in which Jim Doyle, a Democrat, gets reelected governor, in which Democrats take over the state Senate. Yet you had every county but one in Wisconsin voting for the same-sex marriage ban. You had large minorities of Democratic voters and Doyle voters, a lot of African-American voters, a lot of working-class white voters voting for the same-sex marriage ban. And so that was only a little over six years ago. And so I'm sort of posing the question in my piece, you know, how would that same referendum turn out today? And there's no doubt it would be closer. You know, whether it would pass or not, I think, is an open question, but there's no doubt it would not be an 18-point margin, because we've seen very clearly in the national polling a big movement, as you said, a rising support for same-sex marriage, whether it's 50% nationally or 45%, or whether it's 48% in Wisconsin or 46 or 51, we don't know, but the fact is, it's a different world than it was even 6 years ago. And so these are big changes. And we've heard Reince Priebus talk a lot in recent days about, you know, he sort of has to kind of acknowledge and I think affirm the Republican Party's official stance, which is against same-sex marriage. But at the same time, he's trying to sort of signal to people in the party that they shouldn't, that they should tolerate differences of opinion within the party on this issue.
Mm-hmm. It is hard to imagine Proposition 8 passing in California now, isn't it?
It is. And again, there was a wave of these amendments, and in the not too distant past, and they were almost all successful. Again, not, as you said, not just in red states, but in purple states, and in some cases blue states. And so So, you know, whether the court intervenes and invalidates some of the amendments, or whether it sort of defers on the issue, and whether we see efforts to repeal them down the road politically, however that plays out, we know the politics is shifting, because so much of it is generational. I mean, even back in 2006, there was an age fault line, an age gap on this question in the exit polls in our referendum, where, you know, people under 30 were much more likely to vote against the same-sex marriage ban than people 60 and over or people over 30. So we know that that's the direction things have gone in.
Some analysts yesterday were indicating that the court seemed to be saying that they might be getting involved too soon on this issue, that we had to let the democratic process carry on. I wasn't sure I understood what that meant. What kind of democratic process?
Well, I maybe what we've been talking about, which is, at the state level and at the federal level. I mean, legislation, referendums, ballot items. I mean, I think the court is wary. I think this is an awkward issue for the court. I think they're not I think some members are not really eager to jump into this, and partly because you have an issue where public opinion is shifting so much, that's a difficult issue for the court, I think, to intervene in, because they can't, you know, if you can't fall, it's hard to fall back on sort of tradition and, you know, history when things are changing so fast.
Why are they changing so fast?
Again, I think a lot of it is generational. We're seeing younger voters are clearly much more moderate and liberal on cultural issues than older voters. It's also, you know, partly younger voters are also just more diverse demographically, and that's part of the explanation for those changes. It's not just that age, but it's also the makeup of the youth vote, and so so younger voters have grown up in a somewhat different world culturally, and I think there's probably, you know, people who've studied this have sort of concluded that some portion of the shift is sort of like what they call generational replacement, which is just, you know, younger voters coming into the electorate and older voters dying, and then part of it is actual attitudinal shifts. You know, in other words, the same people shifting in their attitudes. And it's hard to say how much is which, but both things are going on.
Craig Gilbert is our guest this hour. We have a lot that we're talking about. We're starting, and we're certainly interested in hearing your thoughts about how the Republican Party gets more people to vote for the party, particularly in presidential races. We'll ask Craig a little bit more about what he thinks midterms, what might happen in midterms, where the Republicans did very well in the last midterm elections, but then the presidential election came, and a lot of Republicans thought they were going to win, and it didn't happen. But we're looking at major changes, demographic changes in this country. What do the Republicans do to appeal to non-white voters and to women? We also have yet to talk about, it would appear, if you're writing a book, aren't you running for president? I don't know. The governor of the state of Wisconsin, Scott Walker, is writing his memoir. We'll talk about that, his possible entry into the race. And I'm interested in more of your thoughts about what we heard. I found yesterday's hearings before the Supreme Court on same-sex marriage to be absolutely fascinating, and today they will continue. So if you'd like to talk about that, we would like to hear from you as well. Craig Gilbert is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Our guest frequently, and here is how you reach us again, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, you can, even if we can't get to all your messages on Facebook, we really like to read Facebook, so put your messages there and we can all read what you think. And that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. Phone lines are open. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, Daniel Golden, will walk through our doors with tons of books and all kinds of suggestions for books for you to read during these spring months. Daniel is the owner of Boswell Books, and he's a lot of fun. Let's go to phone calls for Craig Gilbert. Keith in Shorewood is our first caller. Hey, Keith.
Hey, Kathleen and Craig. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
There was a title for a Second City Review a couple years ago that's germane here. It was called No Country for Old White Men. And what the Republican Party is facing is the fact that every month 80,000 white people die, pass away, and 135 minorities become a voting age. Now, here's the problem for the GOP. Rance Priebus, you know, with his program where he's going to get people to go out into the community and talk to other people, this is what I call his Avon strategy, because basically people will be going door-to-door to sell cosmetics. The problem that the Republican Party has is that parties in this country serve two functions. Either what you're going to offer to people is either the chance to keep what you have or the chance to move ahead. And the Republican Party is too ideologically restrained to provide people, you know, to demonstrate to minorities and women and students that they're the way of the future. I mean, because basically they're people with bootstraps who are telling people without bootstraps to use their bootstraps. And unless they can figure out a way to sell this thing, they're going to continue on the way to extinction.
Thanks, Keith. Craig.
Well, I think I'm certainly cautious about predicting extinction for political parties. I mean, the thing about political parties is that they do tend to adapt when they're losing, and so I think the Republican Party is trying to adapt. I do think it's an interesting question about how much kind of room to maneuver the party has. I mean, and forget about the RNC. I mean, the RNC has a limited ability to sort of direct the party's future. I mean, obviously, presidential nominees have a huge impact on that, and the congressional wing of the party has an impact on that, and the governors have an impact on that. The party's role as a party organization has more to do with fundraising and mechanics. But, you know, there's an interesting debate even on the right about this. I mean, there was a piece, I think, in the Weekly Standard not too long ago, which talked about the party being in a double bind, was the term that they used, which is that, you know, like any party, I mean, you're sort of trying to strike a balance between playing to your base and playing to people outside your base. And their argument was that the more the party, the degree to which the party tries to appeal to non-traditional Republican constituencies, the more it risks kind of offending its base. And then so it's sort of in a bind in that sense. And so we'll find out how big of a bind that is. I mean, the party does have a very energetic, activist, conservative base, and it's always going to run the risk of either demoralizing or just offending that base if it's seen as sort of deviating from conservative principles in order to try to carve out an appeal to different constituencies in the electorate. So that's all going to be part of the drama that's going to play out in the next few years.
It would appear from the reaction of some Republican leaders, including the presidential candidate, Mitt Romney, that they were really taken aback by what happened in the last presidential election. And I never could understand, Craig, because they're sophisticated politically, the people who are running those kinds of campaigns, but there seemed to be this area, this aura of, oh my gosh, I can't believe we didn't win this. Why didn't they see that? Why haven't they seen the demographic changes, the need to appeal to more people before 2013?
Well, I mean, it is one of the mysteries that there was, I mean, the big surprise was that there was so much surprise when there was a lot of public
right.
polling data, especially at the state level, which suggested, I mean, you had to believe that the state level polling was kind of systematically off to think in the end that Mitt Romney was going to win because Obama was consistently ahead in enough states to have an electoral majority. So either the public polling had to be wrong or the Romney polling had to be wrong. And it turned out the Romney polling was wrong. They were making a set of assumptions about, I mean, everybody, I'm sure they understood the raw demographic numbers, but they were making assumptions about who would turn out. And they were underestimating the turnout of non-whites and overestimating the percentage of the electorate that would be made up of white voters.
Mm-hmm.
And so they got that wrong, and I think that's part of the kind of tone in this report, and one reason why it's kind of got this sort of tone of urgency and almost, you know, ringing an alarm bell, a wake-up call, is because of what happened last fall, not just the defeat, but kind of the way it took Republicans by surprise. Some Republicans, I should say.
Thanks, Keith. Marcus in Black River Falls. Hi.
Hi. I'm an independent. But I believe that Republicans need to get more aggressive. And what I mean is, in those debates, for instance, the accusation of offshore accounts and all this, I would call people on it. I would say, for instance, I did it, like on the tax returns and on the Cayman Islands and offshore accounts. I would come out and say, yeah, I put my money in that. Show people that the Republicans are good for business. I mean, you know, if you're going to make an accusation of somebody, say it. Say, you know, where's your proof? Where's your proof I'm a homophobic? Where's your proof that I'm a racist? It takes more than just making an accusation. And I believe Romney could have won that thing if he would have hit Obama on Benghazi and got more aggressive. That's what people want to see. If you're going to sit there and just be, just go with it and try to run an old-fashioned campaign like it's 1980, you're not going to win.
I'm not sure you can defend it's going to fly to get people to support you if you put your money in the Cayman Islands. I'm not sure that you can defend that or get a whole lot of people behind that. Maybe I'm wrong. Craig?
Well, I do think, again, this is sort of part of the internal debate that goes on after a loss, is that you're going to have some people saying, we didn't go far enough in terms of standing up for our principles, and other people saying, we need to tone it down a little bit. And that's a kind of classic debate that occurs, and it's occurring here. But I do think that the greater consensus within the party is kind of not with the caller. Certainly, there's a lot of people within the party who think Romney was a flawed nominee. But I don't know if the classic criticism of Romney at this point is that he was just too unaggressive. I think it was that he was kind of. I think people look back at Romney as an ineffective candidate for other reasons.
Thanks, Marcus, very much for your call. Matthew is next in Waupaca. Hi, Matthew.
Hi. Great show. I wish we had 100 Craigs covering politics.
He's good, isn't he? He's really good.
Well, we need more political reporting in general. This state could use it. Mm-hmm. My point is that the problem is the messenger, Reince Priebus, who frankly put out a document just to cover his failings as chairman of that party. They just got trounced in 2012, and yet they just re-upped his contract for another 2 years. That's mind-boggling. His problem is what the state's problem is. It's been taken over by Tea. He's come out of that Tea party, Reince Priebus himself, with Governor Walker, Ron Johnson, and most of the leadership in this state that was the Republican Party. And I think the real problem is they really wanted to change the Grand Old Party and get back to fundamentals and moderation. They needed to not reelect him as their leadership and move forward in a more inclusive, open, diverse way rather than the gentleman who brought us Scott Walker and much of the Tea Party in this great state.
Craig.
Well, you know, it is an interesting question in terms of kind of Reince Priebus coming out of Wisconsin, and I wrote a story maybe last year or the year before about this sort of, you know, Priebus and Ryan and Walker and kind of how they were sort of their influence in the National Party, and this kind of I think one of the critics of them that I talked to on the left called it sort of shock and awe politics or shock and awe conservatism, which is this very aggressive brand. You look at the Ryan Budgie, you look at what Scott Walker did in terms of Act 10, very aggressive, audacious kind of brand of conservatism, and the imprint that, you know, that was making on the National Party. Now, it does get kind of complicated when you try to sort of compare, you know, Wisconsin Republicanism and National Republicanism. And Reince Priebus is, as chairman of the party, I would say, you know, to people who are surprised that he got reelected, he sort of did two things that a National Party chair has to do, which is he raised money, and he kind of, you know, I think he had a good relationship with state parties, and those are the people on the executive committee that elect the party chair. I think, you know, whatever you think of Reince Priebus coming out of a presidential election, you know, the fortunes of the party are not really, you know, about how the national party chair performed, although you can certainly, you know, find criticisms of the RNC. I think Reince Priebus would probably argue that he wasn't around that long at the RNC, but, you know, he on his watch in Wisconsin, the state party did really well in 2010, and on his watch nationally, the Republican Party did pretty poorly in 2012. But he got reelected because he raised a lot of money and because he had good relationships with the state parties. And now we'll see going forward how this project goes that he's initiated.
Yeah, thanks so much, Matthew, for your call. Well, let's talk about Scott Walker for a moment, who's writing his memoir. You don't do that unless you're running for president, do you?
Well, I think he has presidential ambitions. Whether he runs for president or not, I think we don't know. I mean, we just can't say. I mean, a lot of things have to happen for him to run for president. I mean, if you think about it, obviously he has to get reelected, but I think he has to get reelected a certain way. I think it can't be like a a super close call. I think he has to look strong in his reelection. I think it certainly is going to matter for his national ambitions how the state does economically over the next year, and whether he can sort of change the pace of job creation in the state. I think those are things that matter, and I think the field matters. I mean, you've got two Wisconsin Republicans potentially in this field, Paul Ryan and Scott Walker. They're not both going to run, and maybe neither one runs, but at least one could run, but probably not both. So whether Scott Walker runs or not could in part be dependent on whether Paul Ryan runs or not. So there are a lot of things in play here, but I do think there's no doubt per your comment about him writing a book and his travel schedule and everything else that he has presidential ambitions.
Who are the Democrats thinking of running in that race, Craig?
Good question.
Really? I haven't heard anything.
It's kind of unclear. We don't know. I mean, we just don't know. I mean, you can toss a lot of names around, some of them obscure and some of them not, but we just have no idea. Mm-hmm. And it's just not clear. And that's obviously helpful to Scott Walker.
Right. Charlie in Brookfield. Hi.
Hey.
Hey.
Let's assume for a moment that the Supreme Court takes the Justice Kennedy path and somehow affirms state rights and decision-making on gay rights. Why wouldn't the Democratic Party in 2014 put gay rights back on the ballot as a statewide referendum, force every Republican from our congressman all the way down to the state house to take a stand, get Democrats, particularly young Democrats, to show up in Obama-type numbers? Why wouldn't Democrats use culture wars to their advantage when they've been beaten by Republicans for so long? And by the way, it would be the right thing to do. There are gay couples and children of gay families who are waiting for their civil rights. Isn't the moment now, assuming that the state still has a say in this issue, in 2 years?
Well, the problem is, and a lot of Democrats do think that they can play offense on cultural issues, but the problem is the Republicans control the state legislature in Wisconsin, and it takes the votes of two consecutive legislatures to put an item on the ballot, a constitutional amendment on the ballot. So Democrats really aren't in a position right now to force the issue in terms of putting it on the ballot. It's just, it's not going to happen under a Republican legislature. So even though public opinion is clearly shifting on the issue, whether we see down in the years ahead an effort to repeal this amendment is going to depend on control of the legislature.
Thank you, Charlie. Mike in Appleton, hi.
Yeah, good morning. Going back to the presidential election, it would seem to me that while the message is important, I think the messenger is more important. And let us not forget that while President Obama won't be running again, he's sure going to be campaigning again. And so the Republicans need that sort of person who has that charisma, that ability to speak, that ability to, ignite crowds. If not, I don't think they stand a chance, no matter what the message is.
Well, yeah, I think we talked about this. I mean, the messenger is really, really important. I mean, it really matters. And some people, because of their background, because of their political skills, have an ability to both unite their party and make inroads and broaden their party's appeal. It's not a common political quality or attribute. It's hard to do, but that's why the messenger matters. And Bill Clinton and Barack Obama performed that task for Democrats. I mean, people forget that George W. Bush performed it for Republicans, winning two elections and doing well with voters and competing well with voters, with Latino voters and independent voters. So, absolutely the messenger matters.
Thanks so much for the call. What in the world did Senator Marco Rubio of Florida mean when he said, "We don't need any new ideas. The idea is called America and it still works"?
I guess that's just sort of a statement about the conservative principles, I think. It doesn't come out that well because I think, there's always room for new ideas. I think he's saying we don't need to reinvent our philosophy. And again, this sort of gets back to the balancing act that you have when a party is in the, you know, is coming off a loss like this. The balancing act you have when it comes to sort of building on your, I mean, you're not going to see, you know, no one expected Reince Priebus to come out with a document that said, you know, our, you know, we know we're a party that no longer stands for limited government, or we're no longer a pro-business party, or we're suddenly going to be something completely different than what we are. I mean, that's not going to happen. So the challenge is sort of, you know, without kind of walking away from the party's sort of traditions, the challenge is finding a way to speak to voters that haven't been supporting the party, finding a way to kind of redefine the party on some measure for people that you haven't been connecting with.
Craig Gilbert is our guest this hour, and he is Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. A good part of the hour is spent talking about what the Republicans need to do to get more people to vote for them. Do they need a new set of ideas? Do they need better candidates? What kind of self-examination are they doing? And we're talking about other issues as well, because there's a lot going on. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Spring Reading Suggestions, hour two of our show with Daniel Golden from Boswell Books here in Milwaukee. Tom in Madison, hi.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I just don't understand why the Republican Party is scratching their heads, about getting more votes and how to get into office. I think they have an image problem, and that image is that they come across as a mean-spirited lot. I feel maybe they should go back and market the compassionate conservative idea. Ha ha. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Well, we've been talking about this. I mean, this is a compassionate conservatism thing is kind of interesting because, you know, George W. Bush has a pretty is held in pretty low esteem by a lot of Republicans and conservatives right now because he was seen in his second term as growing government. And yet, you know, if you go back again to sort of the 2000 and 2004 elections, he did some of the things are talking about trying to do right now when it comes to sort of a kinder, gentler look party, about kind of a party that does some outreach and has a broader appeal and education have sort of broader resonance among kind of moderate and middle class voters. So he did some of that, all the other things notwithstanding. And so, again, that's part of what the party is trying to get back to. In fact, you know, some of the people that worked on this autopsy for the Republican Party are people with ties to George W. Bush.
Mm. Here's an email from Glenda in Racine. Even though the GOP held the House, it wasn't because they did well. That happened as the result of gerrymandering. This fact needs to be mentioned anytime there's a discussion of the midterm election results. Gerrymandering worked.
Well, the Republican Party did hold the House that was a big factor, not just gerrymandering, of course, but it's both gerrymandering in terms of the way the districts were drawn, and it's also kind of the natural population distribution, which is a problem for Democrats because Democratic voters are more concentrated in urban areas, and so they tend to be more packed into fewer districts. On top of that, the way the districts are drawn, you know, kind of exacerbates that problem for Democrats because in a lot of states controlled by Republicans, they were able to draw a favorable line. So it's both those things together. It's just sort of a structural problem for Democrats when it comes to the House of Representatives, and it's not easy to overcome. I mean, it takes kind of a somewhat unusual set of circumstances, I think, for Democrats to take back the House right now.
Pete is next in La Crosse. Hello, Pete.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Craig. In regards to Scott Walker's presidential ambitions, doesn't he need to graduate from college before he can be a serious presidential contender? His resume was published in the La Crosse Tribune here about a year ago when he was during the recall election, and it claimed he went to Marquette College, some college, no degree. Is that really enough to be president of the United States?
Well, that's an issue that would get some attention if he does run for president, no doubt about it. I mean, it's probably been less of an issue for him in terms of being governor than it would be. Everything is under much higher level of scrutiny when you're running for president. So it's one of those issues that Scott Walker, you know, would just have to deal with if he ran for president, because it's unusual.
How many presidents haven't gone to college? I'm thinking Harry Truman didn't, Abe Lincoln certainly didn't. I wonder, there have been quite a few, haven't there?
Well, I'm sure I don't know how many there have been over the years. I mean, there haven't been too many in recent history.
Right.
In fact, most presidents in recent history have a professional degree as well.
Right. I've never understood why the governor just didn't finish it up, you know, just do it, take a night class.
Yeah, I don't know.
All right. We'll ask him sometime. Thank you very much for your call, Pete. We go to Mike in Madison. Hi.
Hi. So I keep hearing about this image problem for the Republicans, and I don't think that's an issue at all, because Romney was a good-looking guy, he was wealthy, and he's a great family guy. I think the real issue is honesty. And now, I vote Republican often. I also vote Democrat often, and I base my vote usually on who I believe is the more honest candidate. And unfortunately, I'll use an example for a Wisconsin state governor. There were billboards all across the state saying, Tom Barrett's going to ban your hunting rifles. Big, giant, huge billboards all up and down the whole state, which was completely false and really ignorant on the part here and the Republicans' part. But once again, it goes into honesty. You know, George Bush, I mean, that whole administration had lied and lied and lied. And I think for the younger generation, they're just really figuring out that, you know, there's only so much hatred you can push and only so many lies you can take before you really have to start looking around the corner. And unfortunately, with a two-party system, we're stuck with the Democrats being on the opposite side, who are unfortunately not much more honest than the Republicans. And I think we're approaching the time for a true and honest third party to emerge. Thank you.
Thank you for the call.
Well, it sounds like one of those voters who's, you know, voting on the basis of the lesser of two evils.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure he's not the only voter that sort of falls into that category. I do think, I mean, the obstacles, and we've had this discussion before, toward a third party are pretty daunting in this country, for just because of the system we have. Makes it extremely difficult. Whenever a party is going through change, you know, it kind of raises the specter of a third party, either in the form of, you know, sort of ideological, you know, one party's sort of the ideological wing of a party breaking off or being unhappy with the future of a party, or, you know, more movements toward a third party in the middle. It's just that that's just not the sort of way our political history has played out in recent decades. And that's why I think, in the end, the Republican Party is gonna move in the direction it needs to move politically in order to survive as a party, in order to compete as a party. What's interesting, I think, about the current situation is that you do have this dichotomy I mentioned before, where you have a party that's coming off a super successful midterm election, and then a recent history of poor performances at the presidential level. And in some ways, that may make it more difficult for the party to change, because it's had both. It's not just a run of unmitigated defeats. It's had this sort of historic success in the very recent past in a midterm election, and it has all these, and it controls a lot of states. It's going to be really interesting to see. That's why it's going to be really interesting to see what happens in 2014 midterms, and whether those midterms kind of sustain the party's level of control at the state level, or whether it's another defeat for the party on top of 2008 and 2012.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the state thing, because I wanted to ask you about this. Why is it that the Republicans are doing? They hold many state houses. But nationally, they're not doing very well. So what's going on there?
Well, so part of it is this thing where you know, two different electorates where in midterms, you know, fewer people turn out. They tend to be older or higher income, whiter voters, because those are voters that sort of vote more consistently. And so the drop-off in midterm and presidential turnout tends to be among more Democratic-leaning voters, minority voters, younger voters, lower-income voters. So there's that going on. It's always been there, but obviously Republicans don't always win midterm elections and Democrats don't always win presidential elections. But what you had in 2010 was you had an unusual historical election. It was one of the most conservative electorates we've seen in modern history in the U.S. It was a wave election. And so a lot of the success of the party, I mean, a lot of the party's strengths right now are really flow out of that one election, the 2010 election, where they took all these state houses and they took so many governorships. And so that's why it'll be really interesting to see what happens in 2014, to see how many of, I mean, in effect, the party kind of overperformed in the sense that it did well in a lot of states that weren't just red states, but purple states and in some cases blue states. So it's always harder to sort of hold on to those gains because you won those gains kind of on enemy turf or at least in very competitive
right.
states. And so it's going to be a challenge. Some of those governors will be successful in 2014, but some may not be.
Thanks, Mike, for the call. Hugh in Milwaukee.
Hi. It seems like the Republicans want to win. They should stress equal rights. Ever since Richard Nixon made affirmative action a national policy, whites in particular, and white men even more in particular, have been discriminated against because preferences have been given to others. If you make 11 million illegal aliens, give them the rights to citizenship, they're going to get in head of the line. They're going to go to the head of the line, the employment line, the scholarship line, the admission to university line, because most of them will be third world minorities and get affirmative action preferences over people born in this country. Why give these preferences to illegals? If you want to lose your base vote, then do as this Republican report says and go for amnesty. But there won't be anything left to the Republican Party.
Craig.
Well, I mean, that's one of the reactions to the report. The thing to remember about the immigration issue is the language in the report is very vague about immigration. I mean, it uses the term comprehensive immigration reform, which some people read as a code word for a path to citizenship or what some people call amnesty. But it really was not that specific. I mean, it was comprehensive immigration reform can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. Like, for example, it can mean a path to legal status that falls short of a path to citizenship. It can mean a lot of different things when it comes to sort of the criteria for a path to legal status or a path to citizenship for illegal immigrants currently in the country. So I think it was kind of a nod in the direction of let's try to get past this immigration reform issue, but it was still, you still got a lot of fault lines in the Republican Party when it comes to exactly how to deal with the population that's here illegally already. And I don't think the report was necessarily taking sides. It's interesting. This is why you see, you know, all this interesting debate among leading Republican politicians about where they're going to come down on this particular question. And you've got some people saying citizenship and some people saying no, but permanent legal status, and some people not wanting to do either.
Yeah. Thanks for the call. We have about 30 seconds. We can do this, though. Lynn in Rice Lake. Hi.
Hi. Two things. In my humble opinion, I think the Republicans ought to look back to the 1956 Republican platform where they supported the civil servants, the environment, equal pay, and on and on and on. My other comment is there was a terrific article in a recent New York Times magazine saying, can the GOP be saved? And it laid out what two Republicans are suggesting need to be done for their party.
Thank you, Lynn. Thanks for the call. Should we look at 1956, Craig? Do you remember it?
Different world.
Yes,
and obviously,
yes.
I mean, in both directions, the party was in a different place. But it's the Republican coalition is a lot different today than it was then. So is the Democratic coalition.
Mm-hmm. Well, we love talking to you. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
Craig Gilbert, our guest this hour, joins us fairly often. He is the Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Amanda Magnus for producing this hour. And thanks to Katie Mattson for on-air production here in beautiful Gathering Place by the Waters, downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up in just a moment, and we'll return and talk books. Get your pens and papers ready, because the suggestions, I got to tell you, they're just going to be flying. So let's write them down and talk to Daniel Golden. That's coming up next.